At 26 and a half minutes after the hour on a Transcendent Tuesday, we're ready for Dr. Don and looking forward to this. Dr. Don Clark is a biochemist, a member of the Board of Creation Moments, also a vintner. He resides in Garden Valley, Texas, which is a beautiful spot. And I've got a question for you this morning, Don. Evolution got its momentum in the 19th century before they knew anything about DNA or genes or how that system worked. If evolution were a brand new idea today, do you suppose it would have the horsepower to become lodged into our scientific consciousness like it did, now that we know that the DNA underlies all this?
Well, yeah, it's not the facts. It's not the facts that, we have more information now about the DNA, and we have mapped out the human genome, 3 billion base pairs, and each of the base pairs have to be in a specific order. One would think that you would come to the conclusion that, gee, this is designed. How could you have such complexity and such wonderful molecular mechanisms, and yet it not be designed, but would be random? And the answer lies in the heart of man, of course. If man's heart is deceitfully wicked, as we know that it is, the Bible tells us that, then we'll always find an excuse not to believe in God. And always find an excuse that, hey, if I just do this and if I just behave in this way, then I can become a little God. And I want to be a little God. And so therefore, that old adage from, back in Genesis, we learned that, Satan had planted in the hearts of man that concept that we too can be gods. And so if you have, some information that says, this looks like it's really designed, you're still not going to want to believe it because of that basic fundamental fact that you want to be a little God. It's not until you acknowledge that there is a creator that you can accept, well, if there was a creator, then everything must be designed. And if everything must be designed, you now look at the same facts that, wow, we got complex DNA and we got all of this feedback mechanisms that are within the cell. And we've got signals being transmitted from the outside of the cell into the DNA. And that turns on or off certain types of genes. And this is extremely complex. And then you can acknowledge that, yeah, of course it's complex because a God designed it. And matter of fact, the God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob that we learn about in the Bible. So that's the basic answer to the question. I would still think that man would still come up with a reason not to believe.
Well, there's a reference in the article, Gould mentions it, and that Darwin, in his original thinking, had to figure out some way to make sure that the mutations had to be random. And the reason, and he even theorized a reason for that, because if mutations were not random, if they were directed, then his theory was going to be caca before it was even put down in paper. And I've not read a lot of Darwin. Is there any evidence that he actually had those thought processes, that he actually went down that road?
Well, yeah, the basics of evolution is that it's these random mutations that create.
Mm. Mm. Wow.
And so if you don't have random mutations, then, okay, maybe things are actually designed. So, yeah, it kind of goes against a atheistic evolution. We're not talking about theistic evolution. There is no such thing. God did not design the system, us to evolve. He designed us to adapt, and therein lies the question of the day. Mm-hmm. And so, now we're finding, well, Gould goes on, for example, and he says variations, in short, must be copious. That means, you know, you got to have a lot of variation in order to have evolution. Small in extent, just little, tiny little variations, not big ones, and undirected. And there is the premise of evolution. So if you get changes in an organism, for example, and it is directed and not random, then evolution has a problem. And this whole article in ICR, you know, discusses that in great detail. And in fact, evolutionists, if they're honest with themselves, and some of them apparently are, for example, like Shapiro, for example, has written kind of a book that Evolution, A View from the 21st Century, and he reviews over 1,000 research articles in which mutations seem to be directed. You know, of course we know that random mutations happen. I mean, you know, you expose your skin long enough to ultraviolet radiation from the sun, you're going to get some mutations in your skin, and that then goes on to produce skin cancer. Those type of mutations, the random ones, are non-beneficial. They may be neutral at best, that is, it doesn't kill the organism, but most of the time they are harmful, like in my example with the skin cancer. The type of adaptation that you need, and this is what Darwin based his whole theory on, he went to the Galapagos Islands, and so there he's a naturalist, so he's making sketches of the animals, these strange animals that you find on the Galapagos Islands. And one that he concentrated on a lot were the finches. And he noticed in some of the islands, the finches had small beaks, but if he went to another island, they had large beaks. So he said, oh, well, these are still finches, but some have small beaks. And there's variations. You know, there's some with intermediate beaks, size beaks. But he kind of noticed that, oh, the ones with large beaks, they're on a dry island, whereas the ones with small beaks are on a wet island, or at least, you know, their food was more readily available. So the drier island only had seeds that were hard to crack, and so the species that survived were the finches with the larger beaks. So, and he postulated that the pressure, that the environmental pressure then caused this change in beak size, and then he went off and wrote his theory of evolution. And then man, you know, other people picked it up, and away we go with that. But he based it on all of this, the environmental pressure that was on the finches that caused a change from the small beaks to the large beaks.
And by the way, if anybody's interested in the article, there is a link in the chat window at brokenroadradio.com. And Don and David, as I recall, Darwin had his doubts, because did he not comment that if the fossil record didn't support this, then his whole theory would collapse?
That's exactly mm-hmm. right. So we're going to talk about the fossil record in a minute, but the fossil record, therefore, should show intermediate species of, you know, all kinds of animals change, and the, you know, you have these slight variations as he drew the finches, and those slight variations then ultimately led to a successful population that could survive. So it was survival of the fittest, and environmental pressure causing changes within a species. Well, it's within a species. It's not from one organism to another organism. It's not from a monkey to man type of thing. It is within a species. And so James Shapiro reviews all of these articles, and he comes to the conclusion that adaptation in bacteria appears to be directed and not random, that it is a directed type of thing. So if you have an environmental challenge to bacteria, then it will cause certain you only can look at the population. You can't necessarily, it's difficult to look at what's happening within any particular bacterium. You have to look at the population and see what's happening in the population. But when they do this, and they early on in the article it talks about the experiment where this fellow challenged Escherichia coli or E. coli to an environmental change, and he set up three test tubes, and he was expecting three random type of mutations within the DNA, and when he finally analyzed it, they all had exactly the same DNA change. And he proved that these adaptive changes are not random, but actually are directed.
Now, when you say directed, that's the same as purposeful, correct?
Purposeful, yes. They're purposeful change. In other words, and you can look at it from a point of view that the information's already there. It's not that you have new information. It's that the information's already there, and what is actually happening is that certain genes within the DNA are turned off and other ones are turned on based on what's happening to the environment, and the environment that, in this case, the E. coli is in. So if you have an environmental, stress on the E. coli, it will shut off certain genes and turn on other genes to make sure that it's going to survive.
Is it fair to say that changes in the environment then were anticipated and allowed for from the very beginning?
Oh, of course, that's exactly what it means. that they were actually designed into the organism, not only bacteria, but they're designed into us. And just take a simple experiment. Okay, we can do this experiment, and we do it every day as long as we have sun. If you say, okay, I'm going to spend a lot of time outside, I'm going to tend to the vines, like we have to do. And so in the winter, you're not a whole lot of light out there. We spend some time, outdoors, but we're not spending as much time outdoors as if we have to prune the vines and tend to them. And so we spend much more time outdoors. And so therefore, your skin then is light at the beginning of the winter. And then at the end of summer, guess what happened? Well, your skin color has changed. You have more melanin in your skin, and that protects you from the sunlight, that you're getting more sunlight, and your skin begins to darken. That's, burn, obviously, and others just tend to, respond. I've been out in the sun enough that my skin, responds and starts developing more melanin. But that's a pre-designed system that when you're exposed to more ultraviolet light or more of the radiation from the sun, your skin cells say, okay, this is going to damage me, so I'm going to have to produce more melanin. So it turns on the melanin genes.
It's a defensive mechanism, yeah.
it's a defensive mechanism and helps you survive and helps you not get skin cancer, for example, as we talked about earlier. And so that's adaptation. It was already designed into the system by our wonderful creator. And so the first sentence in the Bible, "In the beginning God created the heavens and the earth," still holds up, that God created, man didn't create, God created, and he created these things. He created everything to be adaptable and to change to their environment. And so, and also to have variations within the of course, we learn from Genesis 1 that everything was made according to their kind. So the dog is going to be a dog. Now, you might have variations. We've got tremendous variations, and we've learned how to, for example, breed out certain traits and kind of, we're not necessarily breeding in, but we are isolating certain of these genes that either produce short-haired dogs or long-haired dogs or a small dog or a very large dog like the Great Danes, and we've got everything in between. But your old common mutt is probably closer to the original genetic makeup, if you will, to the original dog kind than my Havanese or, you know, some people, you know, their Great Danes or some of these other ones.
Or a multi-poo.
And so, yeah, I'm a multi-poo. I mean, and you know, you can cross these breeds and get all kinds of variations, which we continually do. And farmers learned how to do this, you know, with milk cows and with sheep, for example. In Ireland, there's a specific sheep that they bred that has short legs. And the short-legged sheep were bred because they can't jump over the hedge, the natural hedge that, you know, they made to keep the sheep in. However, it's a disadvantage because if a fox came along or a wolf came along, then that sheep can't get away as easily as a long-legged sheep could, for example, because now it's hemmed in and it can't jump over the hedge. But, you know, that's another story. Hmm. So man has the ability to identify a certain traits I want to amplify that trait.
Who was it that said that a rose by any other name is still a rose? Was that Shakespeare? Was it another poet maybe?
Shakespeare.
So dog by any other name is still a dog.
Yes, it is. And, you know, we can argue about the foxes and the coyotes and things. I mean, you look at them and the dingoes, they are very much dog-like and probably came from the dog kind. But now they have, you know, different types of traits. So we've known, for example, I mean, we, the creationists, have known that, okay, if you are designed, then, of course, you know, adaptation is not going to be a random thing. And so therefore, you know, we accept that as a given. But an evolutionist who discovers that adaptation is not random, but actually directed, has got a problem. As a matter of fact, you know, he's got a problem with evolution if he, you know, looks at this. He's got a major problem with evolution because these adaptive changes are just small changes, and it may be just turning on one gene in the case of Escherichia coli, for example, or it may be turning on a whole set of genes, depending on what the adaptation is, in order to get, you know, more pigment in your skin, for example. But all of this is already predestined and pre-arranged by our creator, as opposed to just evolving and having these very small changes, random mutations that the whole evolutionary theory was based on.
And that brings us to the second article, and it helps us make this very point, and this has to do with a katydid, which is an insect. And I'm looking at a picture of one, and it looks like a big leaf. It's an insect, however, with antenna and legs and eyes. And apparently, somewhere in northwestern Colorado, they found one that was encased in stone. And the evolutionists looked at it and said that this has to have been from 50 million years ago or 60 million years ago. Katydids then looked just like they do now. There's almost no difference between this 50 million year old katydid and a new one. And so they concluded, well, that must mean that the evolutionary process was completed in this original katydid, which sounds rather presumptive to me.
Well, you see, that's why I said, you know, man's heart is deceitfully wicked, even when he's faced with a conundrum, as in this case. And there's many examples of this. But, you know, this happened to be a relatively new discovery. And so, you know, the folks at ICR are writing about it and presenting us with, you know, some of these statements that these folks make. You know, listen to the story that the author of the discovery of this fossil, you know, says 50 million years ago is what is now northern Colorado, a katydid died. Now, you know, it sounds like, he's telling us how this katydid wound up in the shale to produce this fossil. So the katydid died. Oh, poor katydid. Mm-hmm. And, you know, he sank to the bottom of a lake and was quickly buried in fine sediment. Well, shale is made up of fine particles, you know, where it remained until it compressed and fossil was a compressed fossil and was recovered in recent years. I mean, just think about that. The whole premise is false. Mm-hmm. Because if an insect dies and it's on a lake, and there's fish in the lake, what's going to happen to that insect?
He will be
lunch. Can't fly away.
Somebody's lunch. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So it's going to be a lunch. And if he happens to survive and falls down to the bottom, it's going to decay long before this sediment is going to cover it over. So from the very beginning, we have a problem with the story. And so, you know, these evolutionists, they just cannot envision that, you know what, there was a global flood, and this global flood, you know, caused massive waves and rushes of water across the land, which, you know, stirred up the dirt and everything. And then, as we've seen at Mount St. Helens, for example, that the rushing water and now you got mud, this mud striates according to the speed of the water and according to the particle size. And so this katydid happened to wind up alive, buried in this sediment that was laid down at the time of the flood. And so when they finally discover it, they come up with the story that, oh, this poor katydid happened to die, and he landed, you know, in a lake, and he, you know, happened to be buried by sediment, but we don't know how that happened. When you ignore, you know, Genesis, you come up with the wrong conclusions. And the conclusion that they, you know, as you obviously, you got to the conclusion, was that they said, oh, okay, this fossil obviously didn't change for 50 million years. And so we know that this particular species, it finished its evolution at that point.
Completed their run. You know, the trouble with evolution is the facts keep getting in the way. And I think they're getting defensive on that side of the fence. And it's a house of cards, and it's hard to defend evolution these days. Don is a member of the board of Creation Moments. I want to remind you of that. CreationMoments.com is their website, and there is scads and oodles and bunches of information, scientific information that supports the biblical story of creation. You'll enjoy a visit there, and we recommend that wholeheartedly, creationmoments.com. Don, every time you join us, you elevate the conversation, and you did it again, and we're glad for that. Thanks so much for what you bring us.
Oh, you're quite welcome. It's a joy and a pleasure.
We'll see you next week. Bye-bye.
All right. So long.
See you, Don.